If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to Net Front Presence. I'm Matt DeFrance of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, joined by Nathan Mills, also of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And, well, the Blues have lost five games in a row. That's the biggest news here. And we're here to talk about what went wrong and how they can fix it, right? We have all the answers, Nathan.
Oh, man, I wish we had the answers. If we had the answers, I think we'd both be getting paid a lot more than we are.
Yeah. I don't think we have the answers, but we can try. We can try it. Yeah. We can try. So I think we can start with the Blues defense, right? That's been the biggest, I think, topic of conversation early on this season, just with how many goals they've surrendered. And it's a lot. I mean, during this five game losing streak, been outscored 26-14 in the 10 games overall, they've allowed 44 goals, which is the first time that the Blues have allowed 44 goals in the first 10 games since 1981. So, yeah. And really that was a different era of hockey when you think about how offensive the game was back then, and how, I guess, offensive.
I was getting ready to make the same joke. I'm so glad you did.
Yeah. So, Nathan, what are just your overall thoughts on the way the Blues have defended so far?
Well, so, you know, at first it felt kind of like, just kind of slow getting together, right? You know, you expect maybe some of that at the beginning of the season, but we're 10 games in now and there's no chemistry. There's no, you know, they're not very physical. They're not very quick to get back on defense. So transition has been a problem. There's no real aggression, you know, at the net front. Maybe aggression is not the right word, but no real net front presence to, yeah, haha, there it is again, right? To help out Binnington and Hofer. And so, you know, a lot of the discourse has been about those two guys, but, you know, the Blues aren't doing them any favors in front of them with their defense, no.
Yeah, I think my kind of tone around the defense has shifted recently. You know, before I was thinking they were just getting, you know, goaltending was getting had by deflections and tips and really saves that they didn't have much of a chance on. And you know, once you figure, all right, well, they've given up some bad goals, yes, that's absolutely been true, but you take these tips and deflections away and what do the numbers look like? But now the way that Jim Montgomery talked about it the other night, he's saying, yeah, I mean, they're getting tips and deflections because we're not tying up sticks at the net front. Like, they're not defending hard enough in those areas, and they have guys that are available to get a stick on a puck. They're not tied up, they're not having a body put on them. So I think that's changed kind of the way that I've looked at the way that they've defended so far. And then the other part that Jim Montgomery mentioned was that, you know, it's kind of a different thing that's happens every game for their defense. Some nights, you know, as you mentioned, it's not having, you know, not protecting the slot well enough. I mean, we saw that in the Detroit game on Tuesday, when the puck's behind the net, Logan Mayhew's pressuring the puck behind the net just like he should, and then Nathan Walker decides to go below the goal line as well, leaving a guy out front open. That's just a breakdown that shouldn't happen, and particularly surprising because of how good the Blues were defensively last year. Legitimately one of the best defensive teams in the league once Jim Montgomery took over, and to see them go from that foundation of defensive hockey and that identity of hard checking, sacrificial hockey to go to this has been quite a turnaround.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most concerning thing for me, is that it's, you know, it's you saw it last year in the run at the end of the season. You know, Jim Montgomery's known for this, and this isn't really that different of a team. I mean, you've got a couple of new faces in there, but for the most part, these are the same guys who did this last year. They should be able to replicate, or you would think anyway, they should be able to replicate that success they had on the ice. And so far, that has not been the case. In fact, it's pretty much been the opposite. of what last season looked like.
Yeah, and really when you mentioned Jim Montgomery and his, I guess, defensive structure in different spots, like, it's changed over the years. Like, I don't think when I first covered him in Dallas, he wasn't a zone defense kind of guy. It was a different structure. But if you look at the goals against and even some of the defensive metrics from his time in Dallas, you know, they had a great tandem with Ben Bishop and Anton Hudobin, but still they were close to the top of the league. Like, Ben Bishop was a Vezina caliber goaltender that year. And a lot of the credit that he gave was to the defensive structure that I guess Rick Bowness put in as an assistant coach, but he wasn't facing a bunch of high danger chances that forced him to stand on his head. And even when you look in Boston, when Montgomery was in Boston, you know, they had a Vezina winner. I believe Ullmark won the Vezina in Boston with him, and him and Swayman were one of the best tandems in the league. So he's had good goaltending that's been protected by a good defense. And even last year, when the goaltending was maybe a little bit inconsistent at times, the defense was strong and held firm. And so, like, I think that's the frustrating part for him, is not only that they've kind of devolved into this unit, but it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole. You know, he's, all right, well, let's protect the net front. And then the other side is, okay, well, we're struggling with, you know, puck management in the offensive zone. That's leading to odd man rushes the other way. That goal in Detroit, the Alex DeBrincat goal, where Neighbors throws the puck away in the third period, leads to an odd man rush the other way, puck's in the back of the net. Even, you know, sometimes it's the tracking back from the offensive zone to the defensive zone. There was that game against Utah where Clayton Keller beats Pew Suter up the ice at the end of the second period. And that was, it could have been a backbreaker, and really it ended up being the game-winning goal. So maybe it was a backbreaker, but it was a situation where, you know, you have two veteran defensemen, Fowler and Parayko. They end up outside the dots. They end up closer to the penalty box in the middle of the ice. They leave that spot, that real estate open. Keller beats Suter up the ice, and it's just a breakdown all around of the Blues rush defense in that scenario. So you have different elements of their defense that have been, you know, breaking down. And, you know, Jim Montgomery is a process-oriented coach. This has been how he views the game, you know, basically since he started coaching, was, you know, the results you can kind of live with, but it's how you're playing. How am I evaluating how we're playing regardless of the score on the scoreboard? Are we doing the right things that lead to victories more often than not? And so I think sometimes we can look at the process-oriented numbers, expected goals, shots on goal, you know, chances, defending odd man rushes, like all of these things. And some of the analytics say that the Blues have actually played pretty decently at 5-on-5, you know? But when I talked to Montgomery yesterday, this would be after the practice on Wednesday, he basically was like, yeah, when I look at the process, we basically kind of deserve our record right now. We kind of deserve where we're at, based on how we've played and how we've kind of defined these certain points that are of interest to him. And, you know, in Dallas, there was five different points. I can't remember all of them right now, but I think the ones that have carried over were win the net front, win special teams, limit odd man rushes. And then I think he had other ones that kind of changed throughout his years, whereas sometimes keeping shifts short, you know, that kind of makes guys hustle harder when they're on the ice, when you keep shifts short. And then there's the other one where you wanted to win more faceoffs, have more possession of the puck, obviously. So there have been different things throughout his years that have changed. But when he looks at his process, he doesn't feel like the Blues should be having a better record than they currently do right now.
Yeah, I love seeing a coach own that. But I don't know how you couldn't, you know, watching the team. You know, I think whack-a-mole is a great analogy for it, right? Last year, you know, in the run, when the goalies would have an off night, the defense stepped up. When the defense had an off night, the goalie stepped up. Now we have none of that this season. And so I think, you know, it's not all the things at once. You're right. It is one or two things a night, or it's, you know, it's a different thing, you know, from night to night. But one way or the other, they've got to get them cleaned up. And, you know, right now I'm so concerned about, you know, some of the guys who, you know, they're the young guys like a Mayu, right? Like you would expect a learning curve, you know, but like Parayko has not looked like himself. Fowler has not looked at all like he did last year. you know, so guys at the top of, at least on your defense anyway, not looking great. Guys on the top of your offense not looking great too, especially with Neighbors and now, well, Thomas at least out for a short period here, and Neighbors out for a longer period. You know, I don't know. They seem lost to me. And so it makes sense to me that Montgomery would say, yeah, we deserve that.
Yeah. Let's talk about Logan Mayhew just a little bit. So he's been in and out of the lineup, healthy stretch, back in healthy stretch. And as you mentioned, I think the Blues know that this is going to take some time. This is something that Doug Armstrong cautioned in the summer when they made the move, trading Zach Bolduc to Montreal for Mayhew. And I think the first four games that he played, the Blues were outscored 9-0 at 5-on-5. And so, you know, part of that is goaltending. Part of that is the mistakes that he was making, whether it was kind of rushing up ice too soon before possession was had. That or we saw that in the Utah game where he got caught at the red line when the puck's going the other way and it's a 3-on-1. Some of the turnovers or some of the decision makings in the corners on breakouts, some of those things that just aren't sharp. And, you know, I thought that he was better in Pittsburgh on Monday night and was okay on Tuesday against Detroit. I think the whole team got outplayed, but I think he was he wasn't the issue, right? Like there were games earlier where he was he stuck out as a problem. But I think it's kind of improved in recent games.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of discourse online about him, especially on Twitter. Granted, you know how Twitter is, but, you know, really laying some of this at his feet and really upset about the Bolduc trade. And that, you know, look, this is a guy who has graduated from the AHL. If he goes back there and dominates, he doesn't get anything. He needs to have rough reps here in the NHL to learn how to be a better hockey player. You're right. I've seen some of the, you know, same type of things. I mean, he had one. Gosh, I can't remember if it was in the Red Wings game or if it was in the, I can't remember. But anyway, he made a dive to try to block a puck, which was great, but just whiffed completely and then took himself totally out of the play. So you have a lot of those types of plays that you see in their high profile, right? Because of his trade, because of his name.
Yeah.
So people are going to latch on to him, but he's gotten a little better. He's not my concern. My concern, like I said, is the top end guys who have not really shown up yet. Although Kyrou's starting to come around. So maybe it's time.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Yeah, I mean, some of those players from last year, the production just hasn't been there. I think the biggest ones in my mind where you'd want to see more, and maybe it is coming a little bit more, Dylan Holloway had a really slow start to the season. I think he's kind of picked it up recently. You can see the physicality in his game kind of show through. It seems like every game he's putting someone on the ice along the boards, whether it's in the corner, behind the net, on the forecheck. Like he's putting someone on the ice with the way that he's hitting. So he's showing up a little bit more. I think you'd like to see more production, particularly when you don't have Jake Neighbors for 5 weeks after blocking a shot in Detroit. And you know, right now, without Robert Thomas, he's missed two games, will likely be out tonight against Vancouver as well. So you're missing those two guys, and you're going to need guys to step up. And Holloway, you know, the expectations grew so much in the offseason based on what he did last year under Jim Montgomery. He was a point-per-game player once Montgomery took over. So it was not like it was a 20-game sample. We're looking at, you know, 60 games or 50 games, whatever it ended up being. like that's a pretty decent chunk to say, all right, this could be who this guy is. And you know, when I talked to him yesterday, Holloway, and he's felt like his game's coming more on recently, that he feels like he can impact the game in other ways besides scoring. It's just that right now the Blues kind of need that production.
The scoring production, yeah. And the thing I've seen from him, noticed from him the last couple of games is his pace seems to be picking up. He seems to be skating faster. He seems to be skating more confidently. And to your point, he's hitting guys. He laid a guy out two or three games ago, and I just thought, oh, there he is. You know, like maybe he's finally waking up. The Bear's finally here, you know. But the offense, I don't know if he's a point per game player. You know, he looked like one last year, but, you know, long term, you know, is that who he is? I don't know. It's probably unfair to expect that of him at this point. But I think that, you know, recently he's looked great. If he can start to get that going, maybe some other guys can get going. I think it feels like this is going to be a snowball, right? It has snowballed down so quickly with the first 10 games here. And I think if they can get a handful of guys going, it will, you know, start. Well, I guess a snowball uphill would be terrible, right?
That
would
it's a weird analogy. I think people use uphill and downhill kind of in a weird way. They're like, oh, well, you know, because going downhill should be easier, but going downhill has a connotation that like you're falling down, you know, like climbing uphill is a hard climb, but it sounds like it's getting better. Like it's not,
especially if you're pushing a snowball the whole time. It's like
a little winter Sisyphus.
Yeah. It'd be terrible.
And you know, honestly, when we talked about more about the production from last year and veteran players, I think we can look at, you know, Fowler has last year when he came over from the trade, he was a top 10 defenseman in terms of points. Like he was tied with Thomas Harley with Dallas. And we saw what Harley just got paid, 8 years, 10.6 basically. And obviously there's an age and difference in market, other things Harley does, but that's where he produced last year when he was with the Blues. So that hasn't happened yet. I think Fowler is trying to do these things. When I've spoken to him before, he's saying, you know, I'm looking at the video. I'm trying to see where there's space. I'm trying to see where there's holes to jump in. Where can I make a play? Where can I break out the puck easier? How can we defend the net front easier? Like he's trying to get himself where he needs to be. So that's been a little bit surprised. I think Pavel Buchnevich, I'm honestly less worried about him because the chances are there. Like you see, he's around the puck a lot. He's around the net front a lot. It seems to be not as sharp as he has been in the past in terms of finishing or just play with the puck. But I'm less concerned about that just because he is around the puck. If he wasn't around the puck, if he was a non-factor, I think that'd be more concerning. But the fact that he is around it kind of makes me feel a little bit better about where he's heading.
When he's starting to really get going on the power play too, I mean, he had two power play goals this week. Well, I guess maybe not this week, but in the stretch of five games. And so, you know, I think that will be a good avenue for him to really get going and is a place where he can shine a little bit. So I think he was -7 in this stretch. And so, you know, plus minus is not necessarily the best indicator of how well somebody's playing individually, but you know, it has not looked great so far. It has been a slow start to your point, but I think those power play goals might be just the ticket he needs to get rolling.
Yeah. And we've made it this far without talking about the goaltending yet. So I think it's time to talk about the goaltending.
I've tried not to. It's just so hurtful, you know.
Is that just a personal thing, just to not think about the...
No, you know, I'll tell you what it is. I really like both the goaltenders. But the other thing is that, you know, I think they've got a lot of heat for this. And I understand how that'll happen. But I just don't feel like they're totally at fault. Certainly there are some, yes, that they have whiffed on. But like... These game results, I don't think are totally on them, or it doesn't feel like they're totally on them to me. And I feel like they're getting a lot of heat from fans on, again, Twitter is what it is, but a lot of folks have latched onto them. And so I've tried not to put too much heat on them. I think they're already taking it.
And I mean, this is they're the worst goaltending tandem in the league right now. Their save percentage is 827. 827. That's about maybe I mean, 900 is probably around lean average. You know, they're pretty far from that. And even, you know, the 31st ranked senators are 841. So that's still a big jump from 32 to 31. Joel Hofer is 68th out of 68 in save percentage in the league at 793. Bennington's checking in at 55th at 863. So the raw numbers are bad. I think the expected goals numbers are just as bad when you look at Money Puck and how they judge goaltenders. You know, Joel Hofer has allowed 6.1 goals more than expected, which is fourth worst in the league. Bennington's allowed 4.3 goals more than expected. That's seventh worst in the league. So, you know, some of these things, the models, they don't account for deflections off their own teammates. I think they account pretty well for deflections, tips, and rebounds, and those having a higher chance of scoring from the opposition, but not when it's off of, you know, the defending team, like that Falk deflection the other night against Detroit, where I think Sherratt has a point shot that goes off Falk. So there are certain nitpicky aspects to expected goals, but overall, it's kind of a good measure of, you know, what the chances are and how teams are performing against them. So I do think it is still something that obviously needs to change, needs to get better. And, you know, I was writing maybe about, well, man, was that really just like 4 days ago or something? On Monday, but I guess before the Pittsburgh game, you know, I was looking at the advanced numbers and how the Blues are playing at 5-on-5. And, you know, at the time they were number two, I think, in expected goal share. Now they're sixth, according to Natural Stat Trick. And I did the research on what if you're a top five team in expected goals and a bottom five team in save percentage in the first month of the season, right? Like these are a special subset of teams that are playing really well with really bad goaltending with a lot of season to go. How does that shake up? And for the Blues, it's actually happened each of the last four seasons. It was last year was Colorado. The year before was Edmonton. 2022-23 was New Jersey, and 21-22 was Toronto. So like all of those teams made the playoffs, and three of them actually finished second in their division. The only one that didn't was the Avalanche last year. And I think we don't need to see what the standings look like to know how good the Avalanche are, to be quite honest. So there is hope there, but I think when you look at those examples, you see just how dire the situation can be, because Colorado, they traded both their goaltenders. Like they got rid of Alexander Georgiev and Justus Annunen pretty much by mid-December. They did swapped them both out, got Mackenzie Blackwood and Scott Wedgwood in net. So they overhauled their goaltending to kind of fix it. Right? The Oilers from 2 years ago, they waived their starting goaltender, Jack Campbell, to the AHL. They fired their coach. They went on a 16-game win streak. You know, like that's how their season kind of changed. They made these sort of moves, and their advanced numbers kind of showed in the way that they played. And then the Devils and the Maple Leafs, they were kind of injury prone. Like they had a lot of goaltenders rotate through the season. They had a lot of injuries to deal with. And then they eventually went and dealt with their goaltending. You know, New Jersey ended up getting Jacob Markstrom a few years later. The Maple Leafs have obviously gone through a bunch of different options in net, and they've settled on Stolarz and Wall. So the good news is that the teams that have played well to start the season, at least analytically, not, I know we've talked about the Blues kind of maladies so far, but analytically speaking, the teams that have played well kind of find a way to turn around. But the thing is, it's just not happening that quick. They went and did something. And so when I look at the Blues this year and kind of parallels to those other teams, there's not a ton. You know, these are the two goaltenders, right? Like Bennington has been here for a long time. He has some trade protection. He could be a starter on Team Canada. He's signed for this year and next year. Hofer's 25 years old. He would be a valuable asset out there on the market. Like it's not just someone who they can waive and send to Springfield, because he would get claimed. He would. And so,
It makes me wonder about the Colton Ellis, you know, losing Colton Ellis. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's, that's another part that it makes it look worse now, because you know, Blues fans can think back to 2019, I guess this would be 2018, fall of 2018, and remember how bad the goaltending was then, and suddenly you had this kid come up from the minors and take him on a run, and there is no Jordan Binnington in the number three spot this year for the Blues. I still can't really fault St. Louis for losing Ellis on waivers to the Sabres. At the time, he wasn't going to beat Binnington or Hofer, and even right now, like, he still might not be beating them, to be quite honest. You wouldn't take him on the roster over them overall in the bid scheme. You know, I think he had a good game in his debut, and that's not good for him. I'm happy that he's getting that opportunity, but I don't think any rational person would think that he deserved a spot over them before rosters were due in early October. So there's that part, and then there's also, like, they didn't know that he was going to get claimed either. Buffalo had injury issues, but there were veteran goaltenders that had played before in the NHL versus Ellis, who had never played in the NHL. It's not something that you think he's going to get claimed. So I don't really fault the Blues for that, but I think right now it sure would be nice to have something else besides Vadim Zhurenko and Georgi Romanov and Will Trantley in the minors.
Yeah, that's a great point. And when I read your story the other day, that was kind of going through the list of, like, okay, what can they do? You know, your story kind of highlighted a lot of these teams made changes with their goalies. The Blues are not in a position to do that. So what reinforcements are coming? You know, do they just work through it? You know,
yeah, I think that's going to have to be the answer. They just got to work through. I mean, these are not bad goaltenders. Like, 2 years ago, they were in an argument for the best tandem in the league. Like, there were other teams that had better overall goaltending numbers, but it was like Winnipeg, where Hellebuck starts 60-65, and Tampa, where Vasilevsky gets 60-65, but Bobrovsky, where he was starting 55-60. Like, these were heavy tandems over there. Versus in St. Louis a couple years ago, where Binnington and Hofer were legitimately a top five overall group. And if you look at it as a duo versus a solo guy and someone who plays 15 to 20 games, they were in the conversation for best in the league. Like, that's the fact. That was 2 years ago. So they have that in them. They didn't just forget how to play hockey. So the fact is, I mean, they're probably just gonna have to work through it and work out of it. And I guess we'll see how long it takes them to do that.
What do you think, you know, what are the odds, right? Like, both these guys have these kinds of major struggles at the same time. What do you think causes that? Is it a mental thing? Do you think it's a coaching thing? Like, what? Just bad luck?
Yeah, I don't know. I wish I did know.
Odd to have them both at the same time, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, I think Hofer's has had it a little bit worse. You know, some of the goals that he gave up in that Chicago game, that Utah game, the Pittsburgh game, like, you'd want a save on some of those shots. And I think the Binnington ones, yeah, I think maybe you'd want him to make a save on that DeBrincat one up in Detroit, you know, for the shot from the slot that's kind of unscreened. Like, you'd maybe want him to find that one. But it's still a 40-goal scorer coming down on you with speed. Like, it's not the easiest thing, but sometimes the goalie's got to make a play too. So I don't really know why both are happening at the same time, to be quite honest. I don't know if the Blues know that. You know,
doesn't look like they know. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it'll be a difficult situation, but I think they've said all the right things about trusting their goaltender and having confidence in them. And, I think they've tried different things. It's one thing to talk to Jim Montgomery about. I think Dave Alexander has had some games where he's up in the press box, some games where he's on the bench. Like, I don't know where that delineation comes from, what they decide to do in certain situations. So I think they're trying to find different answers. But the sooner the goaltending turns around, I think the sooner the team turns around overall.
Oh, yeah, the team goes with Binnington and Hofer, especially Binnington. And the nice thing about having, you know, if you're going to have two guys who are going to struggle, the guys that I want to struggle are guys like Binnington and Hofer, who I feel like can come back. You've got two guys that are confident, that are that have fire in them. They want the net every single night, you know, even especially when they're struggling, because they know that that's the way that they get back to it. So there's at least there's that, right? That at least like they've got the right attitude for it.
Sure.
To potentially get through it. So that's that seems like a, you know, I don't know, silver lining maybe.
Yeah. So that'll do it for Nathan and I here. We have our interview segment coming up next. I spoke to Sean Shapiro. He's a Detroit-based hockey writer who him and I used to be in Dallas together covering the Stars. And we talked about the two games with the Red Wings, kind of the different rebuild styles of Steve Yzerman and Doug Armstrong, the different rebuilds that they went through. You know, Detroit hasn't made the playoffs since, I think it was 2016. So a lot of different hockey to talk to, a lot of different Jake Wallman stuff to talk to too, during the conversation with Sean. And so for Nathan Mills, I'm Matt DeFrantz. Conversation with Sean's up next. And we're pleased to be joined by Detroit-based hockey writer. I was going to read all of the things that you do, Sean, but I don't really know if I have a list long enough. It's Sean Shapiro.
How's it going, bud?
So basically, I think the main ones would be working for Elite Prospects, Shap Shots, Substack, DLLS down in Dallas. Have an acting credit late game.
I do.
A couple podcasts in addition to DLLS, Respected by Whom, Spits and Suds. I think that's everything.
I think so. I mean, there's a couple other things. I'm sure there's a couple other things here and there that I've forgotten, but it's more importantly, you get to hang out with you on this podcast, and we get to bring the band back together after we used to share a beat in Dallas for a while. So I'm happy to be here.
That's yeah, for those that don't know, Sean and I overlapped covering the Stars for a few years in Dallas, and that's kind of how we know each other from those days. And you know, it's crazy. I was actually thinking when I was looking at your Twitter bio and going through all the different jobs you have right now, I was like, you probably could do like a Game of Thrones like title welcome. You know, you're not quite like Mother of Dragons, but it's you could have something like that, like a whole thing.
Just to get like the town crier to read it off for me, like
yeah.
I'm sure I could find someone to do that.
Yeah. I think that's, you have enough titles where it could work. So we're talking with Sean about mostly about the Red Wings having just played the Blues in a couple games in this past week. And so Sean, like when you look at this Red Wings team, 7-3, just had two comeback wins against St. Louis of very different varieties, obviously. The one on Saturday, comeback from 4-0, the one last night on Tuesday, comeback from 1-0. So when you look at this Red Wings team, just how real is this? Is the Iser plan finally working?
Yeah, it's fascinating too, because the result of those two games with the Blues really changes the mood for how you look at this team, right? Because going into this Wings team, they lose on opening night against Montreal, get booed off the ice. Then they go and win five in a row. And then they go win five in a row, and everything's feeling really great. And then they go and have just absolutely no show performances against Buffalo and the Islanders, just go on the road and just look horrible. And so that's kind of the state that they were in when you go into that Saturday night game in Detroit, and they're losing 4-0 there, coming off the heels of back-to-back bad losses. And so it's like, all right, well, this is, the wheels have fallen off. They had five of the first six at home. So clearly that five game win streak was just kind of a lucky hot start, or whatever you want to call it. And then obviously, as Blues fans will unfortunately remember, the Red Wings scored six goals after it was 4-0. And then they go into last night, and obviously St. Louis gets, 47 seconds in, the 1-0 goal and everything like that, and then they come back again. So this Detroit team, based off what they've done against St. Louis the past two games, the vibe feels a lot higher than it would be if the team who had scored first had won each of those games. So it's I don't know about, you say, like, has the Iser plan working or arrived or whatever. I think it has taken the step that it needed to take. It's finally taken a step that they've been looking for a while. And this is one of those things where it's not just that they've been winning games. It's been that you look at the roster makeup for this team in Detroit, and it's no longer just Lucas Raymond and Mo Sider and a bunch of veteran players, because that's what it was for a little bit, right? And mm-hmm. now it's been you had 3 20-year-olds make the roster out of camp, and Axel Sandin Pelika, Emmett Finney, who's one of the best stories in the NHL this year, and Michael Brantzig Nygaard. Michael Brantzig Nygaard is now back in Grand Rapids after his start to the season. But it's still if you're talking about a rebuild and the way things go, for years we've heard, oh my God, Steve Yzerman is such a great drafter. He's done this is be just wait for when Steve Yzerman Wait for his draft picks to come through. Wait for them to finally come through. And he had a long time for it to happen, but now you're looking at it like, okay, you can see the vision, and you can see the guys who are going to become, who can kind of help pilot the window. Like Larkin is, I don't think people realize how young Dylan Larkin is. Like, he's a veteran player. He's been in the league since 2016, but he's also still only he's not even in his 30s yet, right? Like, you think about how long Dylan Larkin has been in the NHL, kind of the nature of the length of the rebuild, and you would think Dylan Larkin's 35. I always laugh at, like, you and I, just from a Dallas connection for you and I, Dylan Larkin was drafted in the same draft as Roope Hintz, right?
And Dennis Gurianov, don't forget him.
Yes, can't forget Dennis Gurianov. This team has, I think, between Larkin, I think it's pretty noticeable this year that they gave Lucas Raymond and Mort Sider both the full-time alternate captain roles. Like, it's been a very clear passing of the guard of, we no longer need older players to field a team. If an older player is in the fold, it's because they are actually contributing, right? They waived Erik Gustafsson. They waived Justin Hall. Neither of them made the team to open the year. They've made the move they needed with the goalie. So it's a team where I think the Iser plan is now, you're seeing it. He took advantage of the leash, right? Like, let's be honest. Like, he had more leash than any GM probably ever would, just because number 19's hanging in the rafters. There's no...
this is year 7, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so like, he got no, tell me a world where any other NHL GM gets to miss the playoffs 7 years, not even never make the playoffs in 7 years and still keep their job. Yzerman has taken advantage of leash no one else would have been given. And so I think you're at a spot where they could be a playoff team. I don't think they are a playoff contending team. Like, I think they are a contender to make the playoffs. I don't think they're a contender, right? Like, it's not like if you're gonna be like, oh, this team could go win something. I don't think that, but I do think they are now a playoff contending team, and you're at the spot where you could now realistically be like, with some of the growth of these players, with some of this, you could be like, all right, I can at least see where it's not inconceivable to see this team be able to win 16 playoff games in 2 or 3 years. Right? Like, you can see the path on that. It's not going to happen this year. I don't think it's going to happen next year or anything like that. But there is, after a lot of patience and waiting, it's a fun time in Detroit because they're winning and they're doing it with younger players, and the older players are actually having to keep their jobs as opposed to just kind of existing, like, which has been kind of the norm for the last 4 or 5 years or so.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think we saw it in the last few years when they went and got, you know, Compher and Kopp and Petrie, right? I mean, they had these veterans that they tried to infuse with the younger players. And I think that's a thing that teams in rebuilding or retooling situations want to do. I mean, I think we saw it in St. Louis with some of their buy low candidates of the last few years, with Kasperi Kapanen or Kevin Hayes, You know, Sammy Blay, Jakub Vrána. I mean, even to a lesser extent, you have Matthew Joseph. Like, they have these guys you try to input into the lineup, and they don't always work. And, you know, a lot of times they really don't. You know, you try to get a little bit older to try to kind of hasten the rebuild or retool or contention back. So now when I look at the two different strategies that the Red Wings and the Blues kind of took, it's not like, I mean, the plan was already there when Yzerman took over, right? Like, they were already at the bottom. It wasn't like he was taking a contending team and tearing it down, but it just feels like such a long process. And that's something that the Blues didn't want to go through when they looked at their roster and said, let's just kind of tinker and go for younger players, targeting young 20s guys like Holloway and Broberg and Mayhew. And, you know, some may work, some may not, but the strategies just seem so different from like a macro perspective.
Yeah. And I think one of the bigger things is, you mentioned the Blues have done a lot of those buy low guys, right? And I think that's been one of the problems with Detroit is there's a lot of that's kind of lengthened the rebuild has been the salaries of those players have not been reflective of buy low, right? Like, I don't think Andrew Kopp and JT Compher are bad parts of a hockey team. I don't think, but when Kopp is making $5.63 million for another year after this, and Compher is made on the books for $5.1 million each in two more years after that, when you're spending almost $11 million in cap space on those guys, that's where the problem becomes, right? Like, I think with the Blues there, or like, for example, like, and I don't want to rip on the Mason Appleton signing, but like Mason Appleton signing for $2.9 million for the next couple of years. These are the kind of signings where Detroit has kind of stepped into, they're moving out of them a little bit, but they've created some of these cap problems for themselves.
I mean, just Justin Hull. I mean, they had to kind of add a sweetener for Wallman because of their cap situation, right? Like, that's...
Yeah, and like, they've got, like Hull is buried in the minors right now. Gustafson's buried in the minors. They've got, I mean, they had... You talked about Vrána, right? Vrána was a buy low possibility for St. Louis because Detroit botched that one. Yeah. So it's, I think that's the thing, the lesson for, I think, Detroit. And I think they're starting to, the one thing I will at least give Yzerman credit for on this, and I think this is something that is, he's at least been willing to punt on his mistakes. I think he's at least been willing to do that, whether you agree or disagree with the decision, right? Like, the willingness to, I mean, I still don't understand, like, the Jake Wallman trade still is a bit baffling from the whole perspective.
But I mean, how about San Jose? Like, they got what, a second and a first for 4 months of Wallman?
Exactly. Like, it's still a bit baffling, and right, like, because, like, I mean, I did the reporting at the time of the trade. One of the craziest things about the Wallman deal was Yzerman wasn't, like, publicly shopping him, right? Where it's the, like, it wasn't, like, I mean, there was lots, and then he traded into San Jose, who would have been first in the waiver order. So if they had waived him, San Jose would have, like, I know, actually, I spoke to a source that said San Jose would have claimed him, right? Like, and so, but when San Jose got a call from Detroit saying, hey, would you be interested in Jake Wallman? We're offered a second for someone to take him. They're like, oh yeah, of course. Like, you don't say no to that good of a deal. And so it's kind of that's actually a really good way to look at the whole Yzerman stuff too, because he is a good drafter. He is a good evaluator. He has been able to, with his scouting team, Chris Draper runs their amateur scouting. They've done a really good job identifying talent that can play at the NHL level and do that. I think they've done a good job with that. They have made some bad bets. And a lot of people in Detroit will question whether their pro scouting department needs an overhaul and everything like that. And that's a fair question. They've made some bad bets with older players, and there's been some questionable asset management decisions from Yzerman when it comes to how you go and either punt on something or make the most of something. Like the whole, the Wallman thing again, if you wanted to get rid of Jake Wallman, that's fine. If you felt like he wasn't a fit for your team and you wanted to move on from him, that's okay. But the asset management of giving away a second round pick when you could have gone the waiver route, when you could have done a bunch of other things and literally saved a second round pick as an asset, that's the more baffling part. And I think Yzerman needed this, like going into this season, we were in a spot where you could tell the team was doing everything to try to shield him going into this season. It was, I remember how many, you and I have been in so many post season breakdowns and everything like that. And it was the GM, right? The GM usually can speak for himself, right? Like the GM is 99% of the times I've ever spoken to a GM, it's unless it's at a press conference introducing a hire and there's some, like it's the GM speaking by himself, right?
Yeah.
But so at Red Wings exit interview day, exit and cleanout day, they had McClellan and Yzerman up at the table together, like at the podium together. And McClellan was basically the guy who kept jumping in to defend Steve, right? Like it was almost like it was this kind of like questions would be coming to Yzerman about the plan and where things are going and everything like that. And there was multiple times where McClellan jumped in and gave answers and basically did his best to protect Yzerman. So that
his boss, yeah, to speak for his boss almost, yeah.
Exactly. And so that was a wild thing for me to watch, because I've seen, if I see a coach and GM speaking together, it's usually because someone's been hired or there's like some sort of like it's honoring some player. Like there's some like something ceremonial about it. Right. Like,
yeah. You're right. They don't really ever speak together. I think it's basically just the hiring press conference.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that happened. And then on top of that, you have one of the longest, one of the biggest fan gripes. And I don't want to, I'm going to play conspiracy theorist on this.
Oh, all right. Let's go, baby.
But the, one of the biggest fan gripes forever has been, why is Sergei Fedorov's number not retired in Detroit? And it has been very public that Fedorov and the Ilitch family did not get along. Fedorov took the qualifying offer from the Carolina Hurricanes, held out, and cost millions of dollars to the Ilitch family, and was like one of the highest paid players in NHL history.
Mm-hmm.
In 97, the holdout was after 96, after they won the cup in 96, and then he held out before the 97 season. And then he stayed there, and then he eventually left for more money again, signed for somewhere else, and left to go to Anaheim. And Fedorov and the, basically it was the Ilitch and the, you talk about Game of Thrones type stuff, like Fedorov went against the crown, and the Ilitches were like, well, what can we control? He's the only player since Gordie Howe to win the Hart Trophy in Detroit, right? Mm-hmm. Like you think about all of Red Wings history. Like,
yeah, Gordie Howe is a statue.
Yeah, exactly. And so Fedorov, so it's been so long. So ongoing thing in Detroit has been from fans. Biggest fan beef for 15 years has been retire 91. When is 91 going to be retired? It does feel a bit odd that when the team is starting to finally take some heat about missing the playoffs for this long, and they need something to celebrate in their 100th season, lo and behold, 91 is getting retired this year. So,
and can't forget the throwback jerseys too. Those are important. Yes,
throwback jersey. So it is the, it's almost feels like just from a public perception point for Detroit, there's a lot of, hey, here's a couple of shields going up to like, hey fans, we're not giving you those wins yet, but here's this. And so I think when you add in that, and then you add in kind of this, I think fans are smarter than people, like fans are smarter than teams want to give them credit for. You could have done all that, but if this Detroit team was 3-7 to start the year, people would be out with torches. Like there would be the, and so mm-hmm. I think Yzerman is getting the, I think his entire legacy in Detroit will always come with that. You can't tell the story of Steve Yzerman as a general manager in Detroit without pointing to his number 19 in the rafters, right? Like, you just can't tell that story mm-hmm. just because there's no way he's holding this job as long without that history. I think that is just 100% thing. If so, but it does go to the larger question when we're talking about rebuilds, and you talked about what the Blues wanted to do and didn't want to do as an organization. If the Red Wings were to somehow piece together 16 wins 3 years from now, and Emmett Finney is a Conn Smythe winner.
Conn Smythe, Emmett Finney, baby.
Yeah, all of a sudden you're like, all right, well, I'll trade those 12 years. It worked. It's a fascinating franchise to look at, and it's also one that, if not for the Buffalo Sabres, think about how much more heat this team would have on it.
Yeah.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk. Crazy weather we're having. No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer. First 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
So there's a lot there. That I think can be applicable to the Blues. First of all, I think Jake Walman, obviously a very familiar figure.
It was funny. So about 2 weeks ago when Edmonton visited Detroit, Jake Walman was fittingly up in the press box. He was coming off injury, but the Hockey Canada staff were there watching that game. So it was, Doug Armstrong was there. Steve Yzerman was there. Obviously Bowman was there. So basically we were only missing Mike Greer to have every GM in the building that had traded Jake Walman.
Like his trade history and his like market value is probably one of the weirdest ones in the league.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Cause he was traded for Nick Leddy. Yeah. Like he was part of that Nick Leddy deal that, you know, Blues fans would probably like to take a redo on. And then I was also thinking about when you talked about Walman, if they just waived him, San Jose claims him. If you really want to get rid of him that bad, you just kind of, that's it. Like that's exactly what the Blues did this summer with Nick Leddy. They waived Nick Leddy. He had some trade protection, and so they got around that by waiving him, and San Jose claimed him, and now there it is. Like that's how it happened. Yeah. So like there were some parallels you can look at. It's similar situations and how different GMs executed them, right?
Yeah.
And then the other thing that really just got me thinking was when you talked about Yzerman and his number in the rafters and like being a GM in his seventh year now and having not made the playoffs, like something that Doug Armstrong talks about all the time or did talk about in the last few years was that he built a lot of goodwill in his first decade as a general manager in St. Louis. Like the Blues were consistently at the top of the league. They didn't quite break through obviously until 2019, but they were a contending team. Like they were making Western Conference finals. They were consistently making the playoffs. If you look across that 10-year period, it's basically them in Boston that have the best records in the league. So you build up all that goodwill. Obviously the cup does a lot for you. Things took a dip after that when the whole decor kind of changed. But one thing that Doug Armstrong talked about was, we've built up all this goodwill. And then by missing the playoffs in 23, missing the playoffs in 24, like that goodwill like disappeared. Like it's gone. Like it takes a long time to build up and a short time to get rid of. And when I look at Yzerman, like his goodwill was built up as a player, right? Like it wasn't built up as a general manager. There wasn't any wins or playoff rounds to look back on to say, this is why I should be around here because look at what I've done. So it just completely different situations for just a GM personnel standpoint, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like, I wonder if, I wonder if I think the closest parallel to what Yzerman has is if I think Joe, it's what happened with Joe Sakic in Colorado, right? Now, I think Joe Sakic got the two things happened that couple big things happened in Colorado that Steve Yzerman did not get. One is Nathan MacKinnon.
Yep, number one pick.
And two is eventually the year that they a draft pick scenario we you and I know well about in 2018 is obviously they fall to number four and they get Cale Makar, right? So like that is the Sakic also obviously got things ramped up a bit much quicker than Yzerman did, and talk about another team that won the Stanley Cup. But I think that's kind of the spot when you look at the legacy fan base and the value of being someone who played for the team before.
And not just play from like a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like I think there's a difference between, right. Like there's
Mike
a,
Greer.
Yeah, exactly. Or like, for example, let's talk about in Philadelphia, right. Where I think Rick Tocchet being the Flyers legend he is as a player, right? Like, I think he is someone who is going to get more runway as a coach in that town because of what he did. Rick Tocchet, Flyers Hall of Famer, everything like that, right? He's going to get more runway than someone who had a cup of coffee with the Flyers and then played for them, right? So that's I think that's something that kind of has made me think about this, watching the Yzerman stuff up close and seeing how things go with all of that. So,
yeah, one more topic I wanted to cover was the lottery, right? Yeah. So that's a consistent topic, I think, up in Detroit where, Yzerman, if he just wins a lottery, he's had some real bad luck. Like, what happens then? And I think that was part of the calculus that the Blues made in not tearing it down and tanking. They looked at, obviously Buffalo, Detroit, and even New Jersey, how long it took, Edmonton, how long it took. Like, these things take a long time, and you need some luck. Like, you need to have some of that. But when I think about the high picks that they've had, right, if I look at since 2019, Seider 6, Raymond's 4, Edvinson's 6, and then all the other ones are kind of later in the first round. Like, those ended up being good picks, right? Like, if they win a lottery, like, how much better are they? I mean, obviously Hughes is better than Seider, but Seider, he's the best defenseman in that draft. Maybe Stützle and Jarvis are better than Raymond, but like, Jarvis was taken after him. Like, it's how different is it when the luck turns, I guess?
Yeah, I think the 2020 one's a really good conversation to have, because I think the whole, like, the 21, they pick 4th and they take Raymond 4, okay? So what if they win that lottery? Let's just play the what if they win that lottery. Do they take Alexis Lafreniere? All of a sudden, like, that's – then all of a sudden – and I don't know if Alexis Lafreniere has a different path somewhere else.
Yeah.
The other one that goes before the intriguing one, just from an alternative universe from Detroit's perspective, is – if they won, do they take Stützle number one? And then all of a sudden, they have the two Germans, Seider and Stützle, together. And then all of a sudden, it becomes Bavaria, right? Like, that's
instead of Sweden, which it became.
Yes, exactly. So I think that's the whole, like, people always say that about the lottery because it's an easy excuse, but then they don't go, like. So often, it's been really interesting for me over the past couple of years, because I've learned way more about the draft, diving more into the elite prospect side of things and dealing with the draft stuff and everything. And it's been really interesting to kind of see how, when you kind of go through it and everything, you might have, in a typical NHL draft now, in my view, it depends on each year, you're probably going to have, if you have an undisputed number one, like, you did last year, like this year we have with Gavin McKenna or something like that. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a one and then a drop off between.
Yeah.
But most years, basically, you're going to have 3 to 4 guys who you could make the case for any of them career-wise to be the number one pick, right? And so, like, you look at Raymond's numbers and everything like that. If you're saying, oh my God, I'm stuck with Lucas Raymond, that's not a, like.
Right. Like, yeah, like the alternative was going to be, like, basically Tim Stützle was your only better choice that went ahead of you. Like,
exactly. Yeah. So, and there's people that I'm sure there would be, you could have the argument over Stützle versus Raymond. You could have that. You could, that would be a debate that I'm sure Red Wings not and Senators fans of, I mean, that's one of the other funny random things covering the Red Wings has been the random social media rivalry between Senators and Red Wings fans.
Oh, didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, it was, and I think part of it happened out of the DeBrincat trade. Like, I think the DeBrincat trade threw gasoline on it, where it was the, like, yeah, he left, like, he didn't want to be. But it's also two fan bases that are in the spot where they, I think they both see the reality of, they both aren't getting in, right? Like, it's,
I've got the better younger core. No, I'm making the playoffs. I've got the exactly, better drafting. Yeah.
So it's the, so in like in Detroit, I think there's a natural, there's become a place in the world rivalry between Detroit and Ottawa fans where it's like, I'm going to argue about Shabbat versus Cider. I'm going to argue about Cider, about Raymond versus Stützle, right?
Like, Edmondson versus Sanderson.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, so if Detroit had won the lottery, would they be a playoff team last season? Maybe, but I don't really think that's a fair way to look at it, because you and I covered a team, you and I have covered teams before where lottery wins are not exactly like, sometimes it's like,
I mean, well, the Stars did win to get Haskinen, right?
Like, they did. Yeah. That's they won to get, when they won that lottery to move up all the way to three and everything like that. So that's a difference. But good drafting teams, and we go and give this credit to certain teams. Like, we hear about all the time about how Yzerman is a good talent evaluator, a good drafter, and I think Chris Draper is a future. Like, I think Chris Draper is a future NHL GM. I just think he's missing is the, it's going to be, there's going to have to be 2 years of Detroit playoff runs, and then I think Chris Draper's name becomes one of those next NHL GM guys, because there's going to be, if say Detroit was to make the playoffs this year and next, all of a sudden it becomes, oh, look at Emmett Finney, look at Axel Sandin Pellikka, look at Simon Edvinson, look at all these guys. And then it's going to be, Chris Draper is going to get a lot of credit for that. And so I think Draper is going to be a hot name for NHL GM jobs in about 2 or 3 years. Basically, he needs 2 Detroit playoff runs and people waxing poetically about his fines, but I think that's going to happen. And kind of where with Detroit and with that whole perspective, if you're going to complain about not winning lotteries, you can't though in the same breath then go and give credit for like, oh my God, look at all these fines we've got. And like it's you can't really have your cake and eat it too. Yeah, in my view on this. So
yeah, because like, and I even think about the Blues have drafted well from where their positions, you know, like Robert Thomas is not a top pick, Jordan Kyrou is not a top pick, Jake Neighbors is not a top pick. Like, they've gotten guys that have in a lower place, you know, and even Zach Bolduc, I mean, he wasn't a top pick and they develop him for, I guess it would be 4 or 5 years, whatever it ended up being. And then they trade him for a piece that they prefer, right? So like, they've been making use of their lower picks. Even like, if we want to go in Dominic Bach, like, they used that pick. He didn't turn out as a player, but they got a Justin Falk out of it. So
yeah,
they've been, I mean, Tage Thompson's not an early round pick, and he, or not a early pick, and he kind of got them Ryan O'Reilly. Like, there is good amateur talent evaluation, and that's kind of what has made them successful for so long, is being able to pitch well in that like late first round. So, Sean, I'll get you out on the here on this one. When you look from a national perspective at the St. Louis Blues, and I guess both their current team now, their outlook in the future, obviously, you know, a little bit more with the future part because of the elite prospects work, and you know about the now part because you're in the, you see the NHL hall every day.
Yeah.
What's kind of your view on the Blues overall and their direction?
I think they are the Blues are partially a victim of the division they're in, right? Like, I think the bar I think the bar in the Central is so much higher right now than a lot of other divisions, right? Like, I think there's, just consistently, right? Like you go through and between when you look at with Dallas and Colorado and Winnipeg, right? Like the way those three teams have built to where they are, and then the way they continue to find what every year each of those three teams have a weak point or whatever. Like Colorado last mm-hmm. year, fixing the goaltending the way they did in season
on
right?
the
like,
fly on the fly in the first right, 2 months, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I think because of the division they're in their schedule, they're kind of fighting a little bit more of an uphill current than, and on top of, I mean, Utah's on a freaking what? Yeah. Utah can't lose. What is it? What is it?
It's Tusky, man.
Exactly. I think if you were to transpose the Blues into another division, I think you're feeling a lot better about kind of their upward trajectory, just because I could see them competing for, you could be like, oh, this team could easily grab with that roster, with how they're built. You know what? With the right thing, put things together, you can go through and see them being a top three team in any of the other three divisions. I think that's a reality. I just think the Central is so loaded right now that it's a tough hill to climb. I think prospect wise though, I think they've done they've made some pretty smart bets on guys. Like I think they've been willing to, I think the word is I think the Blues do a good job of finding kind of that mix of being patient, but not being too patient. Right.
Mm-hmm. Like as far as the development path.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I think the Blues do a good job of that, because I think there's some organizations where they get too far. They lean too far one way or the other, where they hold guys for way too long. And then it just, all of a sudden it's too late, or you rush young kids. And I think the Blues have done a good job of kind of finding a little bit of that happy medium. I am fascinated because I think, and obviously it's someone, obviously you know, you're the expert on him now, cause you covered him in two places with Jim Montgomery, but it's been fascinating for me to watch the evolution of Jim Montgomery as a coach, right? Because we saw him in Dallas, and I remember when he went to St. Louis for the first time after he left Dallas as an assistant. Yeah. He was very open about how he got outcoached completely by Craig Berube in his playoff series with Dallas. And I think there was when he was with Boston, I think part of it was what happened with the goaltending too. But
yeah.
I think there was an element of he got outcoached by Paul Maurice in those playoff series. Like I think Jim Montgomery is a coach that does I think he's learned from a lot of his mistakes. And I'm just to be very clear, I'm not to be petty about it, but on the ice, I want to be very clear, I'm just talking about on ice things. He's learned from his mistakes early in his career. On the ice as a head coach, he had to learn how to coach pros. I think when you and I covered him in Dallas, I think there was a bit of the learning curve where he wanted to be, I think early career Jim Montgomery as an NHL head coach didn't know whether he was supposed to be an authoritarian figure or to be just like buddy buddy with the players, right?
There was one time, he had some drills where they would practice with their sticks upside down and work on just having the right stick positioning without using the blade. There was times where they would switch handedness sticks. You remember those ones where you'd have a left-hander with a right-handed stick, and his rationale was sometimes that can open up some creativity. And I don't remember what day it was, but talking to Jason Spezza, and he was like, yeah, there's some college drills, you know, he's a college coach. And now seeing Blues practices now, like there is none of that. It is, let's get to work. Let's do 18 to 25 minutes on an easy day. And let's do, you know, 30 to 45 on a hard day, and let's get in, get out. Let's get our work done. Let's transition from each drill fast. Like it feels like a different practice than when it first started in Dallas.
It's interesting. It was interesting to hear that, to think, because I was thinking about this watching Detroit practice earlier this week, and Todd McClellan came in midpoint of half season. So this has been my first season to watch Todd McCullough run daily practices where he's not coming in, changing things, where he's not taking over midseason, right? And it's been interesting to see how Todd McClellan is very much a no BS teacher, right? Like, he's someone who they're running things. He's very direct. You can have fun, but the point is it's still a job. Right. And I think interesting to hear you talk about that with Jim Montgomery, to kind of see his evolution, because I think you mentioned like those college drills. There was also times where, like, I remember him, there would time almost be where, it's not that I don't want you to get along with your star players, but like his relationship with Tyler Seguin, for example, like he would be like all buddy buddy with Tyler. And then at the same time would be to us would be very like, I'm going to call him out like publicly. Right. Like it was a very interesting mix he had to try to figure out, I think, when it comes to him. And so I think he's a good hockey coach. I think schematically, I think he's a good game planner. I think he's someone who, I think he's had to learn how to adjust to that. I'm still fascinated to see how Jim Montgomery handles a playoff series when he's coaching on the fly and the other coach is like Paul Maurice would make alterations in a series or in the game, and he didn't really do much of that. And so it's a long story, long answer, shorter, whatever, about the Blues. Like, I think they are going to always be, I think in this division where they are, I think they're going to be a wild card level contending team. Like, I think they should be in that spot with the right couple bounces here or there, maybe another team faltering. But the problem is, it's just this division is who's going to fall down, right? Like, that's the, no one's going to come to you. And on top of that, you have maybe Blues and Mammoth fans need to be getting angry at each other the way Red Wings and Senators fans get angry at each other. Like, only one of us are going to actually take that spot when it comes to you. So.
I guess rekindle the old Mammoth Blues rivalry. Yeah.
Yes.
So, Sean, I appreciate this. This is fun. We haven't talked hockey like this in a while. So, good time.
Always fun, man. One of the things, and I don't really care if any of your listeners care about this segment coming up, one of my favorite, I was thinking about this the other day, on the state of the, where the business is and everything like that, and watching the, and let's give a quick shout out to your successor at the Dallas Morning News, Leah Simakopoulos, who has done a great job over what's happened with some call it hectic days in Dallas the past couple of days down there between NBA teams suing NHL teams and countersuits. But I've told you this before, but I'll tell it to people publicly so it's out there. Like, one of my favorite parts of my career was when you and I were covering the Stars together, because I think we had the healthy respect for each other where we would wake up and read what each other wrote after the night before. Yeah. And there would be times where we would give each other the friendly F you, like, hey, that was a really good story. And then my last one, and then I'll let us go, is we both thought we were being sneaky and getting around things. We're in Boston, and we both leave Stars practice at TD Garden, and we're like, what are you doing the rest of the afternoon? I don't know, no plans. And then I think like 20 minutes later, you and I are both walking into BU's arena separately at the same time, and we said, well, F it, we'll split the Uber home. So
I walked into BU together to go talk to Jake Ottinger, and there you are. So all right, Sean, I appreciate it. For for Sean Shapiro, I'm Matt DeFrance. This was Net Front Presence.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk. Crazy weather we're having. No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.